Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project. Everybody's waiting.
Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Today's June 19th. Welcome back to the show. I am about to jump in my car and head to... I'm not going to jump in my car. I'm 41. This isn't the Dukes of Hazzard. I get in my car very carefully. I'm injured. Like, I will carefully get into the car and then enthusiastically drive to Michigan for the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest. But first, I am very, very happy to be welcoming back to the show one of my all-time favorite entertainers who I've actually had the pleasure of meeting and conversing with, Benny Wills. Benny is a poet, an actor, a master of ceremonies, if you will, and one of the creators of one of my all-time favorite YouTube channels. That's where I first heard about Benny, the hilarious and insightful Joy Camp. Oh, you don't know about Joy Camp? You're going to learn about it today. Benny and I will discuss the impact of Joy Camp, the process of creating and pitching a pilot for a sketch comedy show to television networks. Have you heard about those people? We'll also discuss the recent New York Times article, The Making of a YouTube Radical, that takes us into YouTube's ominous new guidelines. We'll cover political divisions, and then we'll wrap up talking about Benny's plans for the future. And if you were a Joy Camp fan, like I was a Joy Camp fan, and you want to continue to follow Benny as he moves into new pursuits, his website is BennyWills.com. He also has a YouTube channel of the same name, Benny Wills. You can search YouTube for Benny Wills. It's B-E-N. Actually, it's spelled exactly how I spelled it in the title, because we aim for precision around here. But I really hope that we can provide Benny a nice boost. I'm going away for 4 days. I'm going to be virtually disconnected. I don't think I'll have any internet access there. Oh, man, if I came back and he had twice as many YouTube subscribers, I would be so thrilled. You know, you ever been listening to a podcast and the host is like, "Hey, everybody, go do this thing." And like 97 out of 100 people go, "Oh, my goodness, thank God for the 3 out of 100 people who will actually go do that." I'm saying be in the 3 out of 100, but let's actually make that 3 out of 100 like 100 out of 100. You follow that math? Let's help Benny out. BennyWills.com. You can get the link to his YouTube through there. You can just search YouTube for Benny Wills. And also subscribe to Joy Camp. You will thank me. I am going to, if this is the first you're hearing about Joy Camp, I am expecting to receive notes of thank you for letting you know about this. You can post them publicly. So that's it. Let's get right into my conversation with Benny. We are going to start out with one of my favorite Joy Camp videos. It's from about 3 years ago. It's called "I'm Good." The scene is 3 young men sitting around a kitchen table looking at their phones, and some small talk begins. It's also worth pointing out this is done in one take. Thanks for listening. Here we go.
How you doing, man?
I'm good. How you doing?
I'm good. How you doing?
I'm good.
You know, I mean, my knee is a little sore from jogging yesterday, which makes me wonder if jogging is bad. Am I doing permanent damage to my knee by running on it? Is cardio in general bad? Does it speed up the aging process? Because I read this article on Facebook that says it does, but it doesn't matter anyway, because I'm going to keep doing it because I need to stay in shape, I want to look good, I'm not getting any younger, I'm 32, I'm single, I'm lonely, and I want to attract a partner. Or partners, I guess, because I honestly don't know if human beings by nature are monogamous or polyamorous. Whatever. I'm hanging in there. I'm living the dream. Actually, I'm in the process of losing my dreams. I'm avoiding inevitable death one day at a time. I'm collecting memories. I'm feeling nostalgic. I'm looking forward. I'm trying to live in the moment. I'm laughing when I can. I'm simultaneously enjoying and hating my daily routines. I woke up this morning feeling pretty groggy because I had one too many beers last night. I'm trying really hard not to beat myself up over that decision. No regrets. But I am feeling restless and confused sometimes, and antsy and freaked out and happy and excited and discouraged. with where my life is at, and grateful at the same time. And I'm experiencing my parents getting older, and friends of mine from throughout my life are having babies, which makes me wonder if I want to have babies. And I'm contemplating purpose in life, and the life path, and desperately wanting to change the world, but not knowing what to do. I'm asking why things are the way they are. How do we get here? Where are we going? Is the apocalypse imminent? Are we already in the apocalypse? Is it the beginning of a golden age? What is the deal with synchronicity? What happens when we die? Are there ghosts? Oh, blah, blah, blah. I'm chilling. I'm just chilling. Observing a world run by lunatics, where there's never-ending war and never-ending debt, where there's empty houses and homeless people, where obesity and starvation live side by side, where corporations donate money to cancer research when the chemicals in their products are most likely what's causing the cancer, where financial wealth, material gain, and fame are considered success. Frankly, I'm feeling pretty helpless because I'm too busy paying off my student loans and working two jobs to keep a roof over my head and food on my plate and gas in my tank to focus on any tangible solutions that affect anybody but myself. But I'm good.
It's good. Cool.
Oh, one final thing before we get started. You're going to hear me talk about the upcoming School Sucks Virtual Summit. You want to learn more about that? You want updates about that? Go to sspuniversity.com. You can just spell it university, sspuniversity.com. Use the invite code SCHOOLSUCKS, one word. Click submit and new fields will appear in front of your eyes, as you know the new age crowd says. Fill in those fields. Hit enter, we'll send you updates, and you'll get a chance to register at a discounted price as soon as we nail down the dates. All right, here's my conversation with Benny.
Thank you for joining me in the middle of an allergy attack, by the way.
You're going to make that public right away?
I thought we could get it out there.
I'm hopefully at the tail end of this particular attack, and if anybody has some great insight on allergy remedies, or what I'm looking for really in particular is what is it in the body that makes one susceptible to allergies? If you know how to get to the root cause, that's what I want to figure out.
Yeah. Instead of just, you know, going and people get the stuff at the drugstore that you need to show ID because it's used to make meth. That's not a solution, right? That's a Band-Aid. So
yes,
we hung out a couple weeks ago at G. Edward Griffin's Red Pill Conference. It was awesome. Great. I got to see you perform, but we also got to actually get to know each other beyond the public conversation that we had in 2016. And that was one of the highlights of the trip for me. It was great to talk to you.
Yeah, man. I felt the same way. And it was, it was a really great experience. The whole Red Pill Expo and then the subsequent bonfire we had and then the chat we had. Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, those debriefing sessions. We did that every night. It was nice. We'd go to Rich's house and talk about, the day's events and what we saw. What was your takeaway from that whole experience? Being the MC, I mean, you saw everything. You were on stage bringing up like every topic the audience got exposed to.
Well, I really enjoyed it. And that was my first time MCing an event that wasn't something that I produced myself. I don't know. I love being on stage and I love communicating to an audience and telling stories and to be able to be the guy to sort of be the through line throughout the whole experience was really fun. And, you know, one of the things I love about these conferences and these events is I have VIP access to all the people there. And I'm offering something in return so they can see it. You know, they can see what I do. So immediately it's nice to have, it's almost like having a, you know, like my business card, but it's actually my contribution. And so I can get, you know, pretty close with people pretty fast. It's good having resources and allies throughout all this chaos. So I'm having a call with Cal Washington from the Empower Movement tomorrow morning to talk about some things that basically like student loan stuff that has been bogging me down and see if he can offer some insight into how to approach it.
Yeah.
So that's great, you know? And the speeches I thought were all pretty good. The only downside of being the MC, I guess, was that I didn't get to see anything in its entirety.
Right.
I'm running around a lot. So I got to see pieces of everybody, but nothing all the way through, which is fine because I can watch them online. The audience was also really great. And I think, it was a really awesome weekend.
So let me ask you this. This question is going to lead us into our first topic of conversation. As you stood up there and looked out at hundreds of faces, did you get the impression that, I mean, it could have been close to, I don't know, 700-800 people who could have been sitting in that room at once, maybe more. I'm not good at estimating crowd sizes.
Me either.
Did you get the impression that a lot of people knew who you were?
I always go into these situations expecting no one to know who I am.
Right.
So
same.
I'm always kind of, when I'm kind of surprised when people do, because it's, you know, when you're doing online content, you just don't know who's seeing it, or if you just have one group of people that sees everything and it doesn't reach anybody else. So I always expect people don't know who I am, and I'm going to have to go there and show them who I am. And I think it's probably more like that. I think there's usually a handful of people that know Joy Camp at these events. And that's always really cool. It's always a nice surprise. But it's nice to walk away knowing that everybody knows who I am.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's a great take on it. Because I've been in front of crowds before and like can't get the idea out of my head or the question out of my head. Do you people even know who I am? And then it kind of makes me a little bit more guarded with my sense of humor, because if they don't, you know, they're not familiar with, you know, how I would tell a joke or something, I could offend somebody or scare somebody or just make somebody feel very disoriented. So I wonder what that's like for you as somebody who's more comfortable being on a stage.
I just don't care. I mean, I'm going to do my thing no matter what. And, you know, it's, if they know who I am, then hopefully they like me and they're excited to see me again. And if it's their first time experiencing what I do, I'm excited that I get to share it with them. So it's all good. And I, you know, I always just tell myself about going on stage, like if everybody hates me, well, I have people in my life that love me, so they're still going to love me even if these people hate me. And that kind of gives me the, kind of calms the nerves and gets me to move through some of that fear.
Yeah, absolutely. The reason why I asked that question is I think you have done some really important work that at this point it's gotten appreciation, and I'm sure you appreciate all the appreciation that has come in as far as Joy Camp is concerned. But when I first saw the videos that you guys were making, you're part of this, can I call it a troupe? Is that a fair word?
Yeah,
a comedy
sure.
troupe, tackled some really difficult subjects that are often emotionally triggering for people, things that people are really standoffish about, a lot of conspiracy topics, political, social. Towards the in the recent years, you start to get more into social issues, and it reminds me of, you know, I think it was George Carlin who said, if you're going to tell people the truth, make sure you make them laugh or they'll kill you, you know. And Joy Camp, the utility that I saw of it, in addition to being very entertaining, and a lot of us who are already sort of on the path of, you know, trying to figure out what's going on in the world, we're just relieved to see something like this. But it also provided like a really great bridge to, you know, where we are and where a lot of people are. And I think that's the thing. You have to, if you want to convince somebody, if you want to persuade somebody, a lot of us have this, I certainly had in the past, this bad habit of demanding that people meet me here, right? Meet me where I am, and not being willing to meet people where they are. And you guys extend this bridge is like, let's laugh about this first. This isn't all have to be serious, paranoid, you know, people in their bait, whatever the model that people use for those who think differently or those who think out of the mainstream, right? There's some very negative pictures that people paint of that. You guys make people laugh, and that's a great way to connect. And it's a great way to introduce a lot of really controversial and difficult topics to people. So I think that you guys were doing really valuable work.
I appreciate that, man. Yeah. And we did too. And it was really fun. And that was that's what kept us doing it, was how much fun we were having doing it. And we were always pretty surprised and often disappointed that it wasn't being seen more. And, you know, we appreciated all the I guess, views that we got and that we have, but it was strange to us that it didn't take off a little more. And we would talk about possible reasons why that happened. And I don't know, if it had been more popular, we probably would still be doing it more often anyway, because it just, we were all in for a little while there, and I think we all would have been totally happy leaning into it even more had there been more response. But everyone has to live their life, and for some of the guys that means having full-time jobs.
Yeah.
And I'm not like that. I can't stand being an employee. So I got out of LA. So I got out of there and doing my own thing now. So it's really hard to do the JoyCamp videos because we're not in the same state. But yeah, we had a great run. And I think YouTube has so many problems that are beyond just what's going on now. And there's a sense of like, it has to always be happening now, every day or every couple of days. In order to have success in YouTube, you have to be contributing to YouTube. And we were never good at that. We were good at making quality content that we released when we were ready to release it. And that was really hard to create momentum with. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have to stay relevant by posting a lot on YouTube. And we never did that. You know, it sort of just led to a very slow growth. And especially when you're dealing with subject matter, like you mentioned, like, that's controversial. And then of course we also have videos flagged and taken down and strikes against our account. And I think when that starts to happen, there's a little more attention to your channel. And we definitely have seen some strange, you know, ups and downs and view counts go down and subscribers getting unsubscribed. And JoyCamp's awesome. And I wish more people would still discover it, because I think a lot of these videos are timeless.
See, that's the thing. Like, YouTube is what it is. And unlike some people making a lot of news right now, I don't expect the platform to cater to me. I know you don't expect it to cater to you guys. It's kind of set up to work as a business in this way. And that's understandable. It's not my platform. And it's not, I mean, the way that it works algorithmically does not work for me. I put a lot of work into videos like you guys did. I couldn't produce a video every day. I don't have something that I think is interesting to say every day.
Exactly.
Now, some people have what they feel, and what a lot of other people feel, obviously, is an interesting thing to say 3 or 4 times a day. The problem is that all of those videos are completely ephemeral in that, like, a day or two later, literally a day or two later, nobody cares anymore. And I feel I think it's an important service, like people who are focusing more on like current events and current cultural issues, but it does contribute to noise. You know what I mean? And it's harder to find those timeless, really meaningful things. Like, documentaries never come up in my suggesteds anymore on YouTube. Mm-hmm. It's all, and obviously it's indicative of how my behavior is on YouTube, which is certainly, I would say, suboptimal as far as like continuing to educate myself. Like, I am attracted to those flashes of this is happening, that is happening. I think a lot of us are. I think we're all still many of us are still trying to figure out how to navigate that. But did you guys ever try to re-strategize with those concerns in mind, or just an evaluation of where you were at and how you could do things differently?
We did. I mean, and when we were making the videos, especially the first couple of years, we would always tell ourselves, YouTube's not the goal here. Mm-hmm. And we're not trying to be big on YouTube. We are producing quality content, and we think we'd have success, you know, exploring an avenue that wasn't YouTube, that was more conducive to our content approach, which was quality over quantity. So we did. And at that time, I mean, things have really changed in the last couple of years in that, you know, when we were putting together a show, we have a pilot episode on our channel called Kill Switch, which we spent about a year putting together, and we had a budget for it, and we pitched it around Hollywood.
Yeah.
And at that time, we thought we had a good chance of getting picked up, because conspiracies were less taboo. In fact, that was when Mr. Robot was blowing up. I mean, that show was winning Emmys. So we thought, okay, this is our way in. And we thought this would be a way to, and because it is comedy, we can get these ideas to the mainstream in a way that's very palatable and inoffensive. So we really honed in on that. And we took meetings. We shopped this pilot all over town. And I mean, looking back, it's no surprise that it didn't get picked up, because it is too controversial and does make people think. And now looking at what they've done, what the mainstream has done since then to demonize anybody who's got a different perspective on reality other than what the mainstream wants, no wonder we didn't get picked up. And, you know, frankly, it's probably a blessing in disguise, because my concern when we wanted to make a show is, I don't want to lose creative control over this content. I don't want to have to compromise my values or my integrity in order to get paid to do this. So I was always kind of on the fence, but I thought, well, this is the natural trajectory. Someone's going to see it through. And of course that trajectory led to JoyCamp sort of, you know, going on hiatus and me moving to Washington and doing what I'm doing now. So it is what it is, but you know, we gave it a valiant effort to be outside of YouTube.
So let's talk just a little bit about Killswitch, if you can.
Sure.
What was the premise? What was like the broad outline of the show? And then as a follow-up question, I'd like to know a little bit about the pitching process, how you made those decisions, and what were the highlights as far as like rejections or responses were concerned when you did pitch it?
Yeah, okay. A guy discovered us, essentially. A producer in L.A. Found Joy Camp and loved it. And he reached out to us and said, nobody else is doing this. And he really wanted to produce a pilot for us. So we started brainstorming, and we had been, every idea that we had for a video, potential idea, we'd been documenting for since we started Joy Camp. So we had just a surplus of ideas, and we ended up always going with something that was current. So the list kept getting pushed back, sort of. We had all these ideas, and we would sit around and brainstorm, like, what of these ideas could we develop further? Dozens of ideas for sketches and for plot lines and all kinds of stuff. And then we just chiseled away at it until we finally found something that we liked. And I mean, I wrote a whole script. I wrote a whole script, like a 22-minute pilot, whole thing, and it got totally rejected, which was fine. But then we ended up coming up with this new idea, and there was we wanted it to be a sketch comedy show with a narrative. So there was a through line and there were characters, but then it would branch off into sketches.
Yeah.
And the way we pitched it, we said it's Mr. Robot meets Mr. Show. Yeah.
That is a great pitch. I love that.
I was just telling Sonia, my fiance, the other day about the pitch packet. I mean, I outlined again a whole 10 episode arc for this thing. And I mean, in detail, we have screenshots and we have sketch breakdowns and plot breakdowns and names of every sketch, names of every episode. And I mean, it was thorough. We were ready.
Yeah.
And it's now just it's just kind of like a cool creative project packet, but it was all ready to go. And it took us forever to get this thing together. So that's when our content really started to slow down on YouTube, is when we decided to put all of our eggs in this one basket and really go for it. So all of 2015, was it 2015? Yeah, I think it was 2015 that we spent brainstorming, writing, and then putting a crew together, getting a budget assembled, and filming it. And then editing took forever for this thing. I mean, just months and months of editing. But you can see it in the final product. I mean, you can see the energy that went into it. We really went all in. Maybe we're just too big for our britches. Maybe we should have just made it either a narrative or a sketch show, but we decided to make it both.
Yeah.
Then we started shopping it around, and we had like three different versions of it. We had an 18-minute version, maybe a 15-minute version, and a 12-minute version, or maybe even 10 minutes. We had like varying lengths depending on what meeting we were taking and how much time we had in that meeting. And we would watch it there with the people from the networks, and everybody liked it. That was the good part. And the frustrating part is you could tell a lot of these people were taking the meeting just because they had to take the meeting because they had set it up. So they came in kind of like, you know, not just neutral really, or distracted by other things, and they were fine. They shook our hands and we sat down, and then you could actually see that they were genuinely impressed with what they were watching. But then there was a confusion afterwards. And a lot of times they'd say things like, well, we don't really know who the audience is. You know, who is this for? And you could see them trying to figure out in their minds how this could be profitable for them or how they could sell it. And they were just coming up blank for the most part. So it was a double-edged sword. It was great to see that it was, you know, in a town where everybody's trying to do something different and interesting and hip and relevant, that they actually did really like what we were doing. But ultimately, no one knew what to do with it and no one wanted to touch it. So we got some interesting responses. I mean, Comedy Central famously at this point told us that it was too smart for Comedy Central.
Interesting.
Which is sort of a bitter pill to swallow.
I don't know. They pride themselves, it seems, on the smartest of, you know, political and social commentary. So
that's interesting. Too smart for us. And of course, at that time, I was like, well, this is the channel that promotes workaholics. So I could see where this one would be a little too intelligent. We got a lot of meetings. We met with like FX and AMC and MTV and Epix and a bunch of online platforms. And I mean, some of them wanted us, some of them were so impressed. They're like, okay, give us more ideas. Like, let's figure out a show, a different show for you guys. And we started playing around with that. We started brainstorming on other ideas. And I don't know. My heart was in that.
Was there also a concern that once you kind of, like, you go with sort of a finished product, right? And mm-hmm. you said, here's the pilot, here's the arc. This is, it's kind of confined to this is our creation.
Yeah.
When I would think, and maybe I'm paranoid or maybe I'm cynical and maybe it's just a lack of experience, I don't know. But to go into one of these rooms and to say, okay, let's open up a collaborative process, I would have a fear if I were you or if I were Kevin that this is going to like lose our voice a little bit. It's going to become something else. And we're just going to kind of be the in front of the camera talent of something that is really not our creation.
Yeah, man. That was my concern all along.
Yeah.
And I wrestled with that the whole time. Like I said, I didn't want to have to sacrifice any of my integrity or creative control. And that's part of the territory. So it was definitely a concern, but I guess I justified it to myself by thinking, well, I'm clever enough to be able to, you know, ninja my way around those restrictions because that's what we've been doing already. I mean, we've been doing comedy that toes the line, and drops truth, but in a very subtle way. So I thought, well, you know, I'll be able to figure it out and roll with the punches.
Yeah.
And of course, who knows if I would have or not. Certain things I think if we tried to pitch or do might have gotten us completely shut down. In retrospect and where I'm at now in life, I'm totally cool with it all unfolding the way it did. In fact, I'm really glad it didn't get picked up because Hollywood is a monster and it's actually, everything's just gotten more and more dark and there's more and more propaganda, than ever coming out of there and more hatred towards perspective. And I'm really glad to be out of there and I'm really glad to be on my own individual path now.
So there's two paths we can go down from there. I want to go down both of them. You are in the process of creating a new personal brand, a new YouTube presence for yourself. I want to wrap up the show today with plenty of time to talk about, you know, what your revelations were, what changed for you and how that resulted in a new direction. But you just brought up something else that I think is really worth talking about, especially considering a lot of the news that's happening right now about online news, entertainment, and air quotes, education. With YouTube. And I feel like we're seeing a concerted effort, almost like a collusive effort with legacy media to influence or maybe even in some ways minimize the effectiveness of these other forms of media, these new forms of media that we were all so excited about 5 years ago, 10 years ago. YouTube being front and center in that controversy right now. Did you happen to see the New York Times article about this kid, Caleb Kane, I think his name was?
I did, yeah. I read as much of it as I could stomach. I don't even think it's true. I mean, maybe its aspects are true, but when this kid said he called Lauren Southern his fashy bae because she was a fascist babe.
Yeah.
BS. No way. That just smells of absolutely made up. No one would do that. She wouldn't call herself a fascist. So why would he call her a fascist and then call her fashy bae? It was a ridiculous article. It was a total hit piece with no evidence, no, only ridicule and dismissiveness towards these people that are, you know, regardless if you agree with them or not, like they're not horrible monsters there to set traps so that you get brainwashed into not accepting liberal left-wing nonsense.
Oh, but see, now they're part of a funnel. See, that's the thing. It's like if you take Stefan Molyneux's channel, like I was a big Stefan Molyneux fan back in the day. He was hugely influential. But if you dig into Stefan Molyneux's work, you know, and you're a libertarian or even not quite where Stefan Molyneux is, you would go, yeah, I didn't like it when he sang the national anthem when Trump won. Or I didn't like, you know, this glee that he expressed about, you know, discovering that minority crime statistics are way higher than white. Like there's lots of, he would say that's not an argument, you know, but I would say there was an aesthetic about what he was becoming that I just didn't enjoy. And that lessened my enthusiasm about watching his videos. I still watch them. I still get value out of the work that he does. And, you know, in the beginning, and I think I was also less of a critical thinker, even when I started becoming like more libertarian and even when I started my show, I wasn't applying the necessary amount of skepticism because I was very excited about the discovery of this new world. And he seemed like a very, very authoritative voice. And I wanted to listen to what he had to say. But I mean, very, very quickly, as much as I liked him, he was extremely helpful to me, like personally. He helped me, you know, improve the audio quality of my show. He advised me about matters professional and personal. I owe him a lot. And yeah, I mean, ultimately, I didn't like everything about what his channel became, but I still think he is a voice worth listening to, you know? And to position him now in a funnel that leads to Nazism, that leads to white supremacy and white nationalism and ethno states, that is, it's, I mean, unfair, who cares, but it's really irresponsible if the New York Times was doing journalism. They've been trying to carve this out for a while. You remember the whole map they did of like YouTube influencers and who connects to who, talking about all these people as a gateway. It is attaching them. It's guilt by association, right? It's kind of like Red Scare stuff. That connects them to the Richard Spencers or the David Dukes, who are still on YouTube and still on Twitter because they're useful foils, right, for the left or for whatever gatekeepers there are to say, look, this is what we're fighting against. See these people? They're terrible. This is why we need to ban all of these lesser people who are leading you to them.
I pretty much agree, well, if not completely, with everything you just said. I mean, Stefan Molyneux was very helpful in certain ways. And I mean, the irony is that all these people on there, whether I've listened to them or not, all the alternative perspectives help me think for myself.
Yeah.
And I don't take anybody's word as gospel. I don't take anybody's point of view or opinion as the only opinion. It's just there for perspective. And Stefan, I mean, I found myself actually having to defend Stefan Molyneux, which is a strange position to be in.
Sure,
often. Because if I say I like him, there's so many knee-jerk responses, whether it's from anarchists or people who are following mainstream. And I think it doesn't, just because I like the guy doesn't mean I agree with everything he has to say. He offers perspective that I appreciate and I don't always seek it out or even agree with it. And sometimes he actually pisses me off in what he says, but I can think for myself. I'm a capable human being with my own thought process and process of discernment. And I can, you know, take some stuff from him and not take some stuff from him. He's not brainwashing anybody. And all these other people too. I mean, they're all just giving you a perspective, and to shut it down is, well, ridiculous.
To put an even finer point on it though, I would say that one of the reasons why he features so prominently in that New York Times article is I would agree that he's certainly not brainwashing people, and he's certainly not engaged in an active campaign to brainwash people, or most of the things that he's been accused of, right? Like getting people to be alienated from their families. He was very, very concerned. And I know because somebody asked me about that in a speech I was giving back in 2010, and he called me. I mean, this was back when he was an easy person to access. He called me immediately and said, I want to talk about that on your show. I'm very, very concerned that this defooing thing is kind of getting, so I mean, he was very guarded and sensitive about that. And he didn't like that that was becoming attached to his emerging brand at the time. But as I got into his work and I started to go to more events and, you know, the online world became more interconnected and it became easier through Facebook 2010, 2011 to interact with people around similar interests, I started to realize that there were some troubling aspects to his whole community. There were a lot of people seeking leadership that he was, even if it wasn't intentional, providing. People had holes in, you know, mentors or in parental relationships that he was filling with this community. And I just think it had like a natural form to go that way. And because of that, you start to see the emergence of things like, I don't even want to mention them, but there are sites dedicated to like, I was part of the FDR cult and I freed myself from it. And I don't know what causes people to like go in that direction. But as people are researching very much a hit piece on that segment, on that space of media, whatever, you know, Stefan Molyneux, I would say, is philosophically an anarcho-capitalist who has pragmatically adopted a bunch of political and social views. And I have lots of theories about why he's done that. I think he certainly understands that he's smart and talented. And in the libertarian circles, he never got, you know, the appreciation or the views or the exposure or the revenue commensurate, I think, with his talents and what he was providing at one point. And I think that, like, I'll just give you an example. he used to talk all the time about peaceful parenting, about how spanking, I mean, these are really important things, the Bomb in the Brain series that are going to get, you know, as far as like mainstream understanding is concerned, they're going to get flushed down the toilet of this is a gateway to Nazism, which is, I think, pretty tragic. All of these videos, you go back in his history, 7-8 years before he started talking about women or single moms or immigration or aligned himself with certain alt-right figures or began speaking favorably about the Trump campaign or presidency, those videos have like 4,000 views, you know, 4,000 views on the subject of child trauma, sexual abuse, the impacts that those things can have later in life. Then he takes his free domain train through all of these movements, right? Starts with Bitcoin. Then he kind of moves on to a lot of these men's rights type issues, and eventually, you know, winds up, I would say, flirting with certain alt-right figures like Vox Dei to a certain degree. And every stop that the train makes, he picks up a bunch of people because he's interesting and he's engaging and he's smart. And I was really hopeful that the train would circle back around to kind of where it started, even if a lot of us are learning that the dream of a free world that we had maybe when Ron Paul first emerged is less realistic than we thought. It's certainly not maybe as close as some of us thought it was in 2007, 2008. So maybe it's not going back to the exact same place, but he would return to what people would perceive as the principled position that attracted so many to him to begin with. But he's picked up so many followers along the way that when Milo Yiannopoulos had his huge controversy about priest sexual abuse is actually like gay mentorship, And they tried to use that to destroy Milo. Steph just puts out a video called Milo. Same themes, right? Childhood trauma, bomb in the brain, spanking, all of these things come up. That video, 600,000, 700,000, 800,000 views. So now that many people have heard that message, right? Now, did it resonate? What did they do with it? I don't know. But it's better. The odds are much better, comparing that Milo video to one of those old videos that has 3,000 or 4,000. But the whole point is for him to get brushed off as a person who is merely just there. He's just a stop on the pipeline to, you know, racism and sex misogyny, whatever. That's unfortunate.
Agreed.
You know, the other thing, too, about the New York Times piece is it seems to operate with this premise that people can't think critically. You know, we assume the starting point is people are incapable of critical thought, right? So you said Steph was maybe, and we could take out Steph and insert plenty of other people who've come under fire here as well. I would say to watch how somebody outside of the mainstream analyzes the mainstream, whether it's culture, whether it's politics, whether it's economics, education, and you start to see how their thought, their evaluative or their critical thought process works around this thing. And you realize that almost nobody in the world does that. It's not saying you have to wind up thinking exactly like this guy. Maybe you do in the beginning, right? Before you start to feel more confident about your own ability to think critically. But eventually, I mean, I think what you're getting is a model for how to evaluate, for how to ask questions about things that most people are not questioning. And that's a very useful thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's obvious that they're just trying to demonize anybody who has an opinion or perspective that's outside of the accepted narrative.
And just like, before we move beyond this article, I'm just trying to think of like, what else do I need to get out about this? Cause it's kind of my chance. If you didn't stick around till the end of the article, I think the basic storyline is he experiences a fall away from left-wing ideas, and then he experiences a recovery. Right. So the fall away from left wing ideas is that YouTube's algorithms are feeding him increasingly radical content, on which Molyneux and Lauren Southern are stops to eventually get to Jared Taylor. Then he starts to see videos of people debunking or debating those ideas, and he's kind of saved. Right. So he's a non-actor. He has no self-efficacy. And then there's maybe like one paragraph at the very end of the story, you know, in his redemption. Let me actually just read this to you because sure. This is where, like, if you thought it was bad before the end, this is the end. This will take me maybe like 2 minutes to read.
Okay.
What is most surprising? This is after the recovery. What is most surprising about Mr. Kane's new life on the surface is how similar it feels to the old one. He still watches dozens of YouTube videos every day and hangs on the words, right? No agency, of his favorite creators. It is still difficult at times to tell where the YouTube algorithm stops and his personality begins. Perhaps this shouldn't be a surprise. Our political culture is now built largely on shape-shifting internet platforms, which have made flipping partisan allegiances as easy as changing hairstyles. It's possible that vulnerable young men like Mr. Kane will drift away from radical groups as they grow up and find stability elsewhere. It is also possible that this kind of whiplash polarization is here to stay as political factions gain and lose traction online. Near the end of our interview, I told Mr. Kane that I found it odd he had successfully climbed out of a right-wing YouTube rabbit hole only to jump into a left-wing YouTube rabbit hole. I asked if he considered cutting back on his video intake altogether. Pick up a newspaper, Caleb. Why not? Rebuild some offline relationships. He hesitated and looked slightly confused. For all its problems, he said, YouTube is still where political battles are fought and won. Leaving the platform would essentially mean abandoning the debate. He conceded, though, that he needed to think critically about the videos he watched. And it ends with this quote. YouTube is a place to put out a message, he said, but I've learned that you can't go to YouTube and think that you're getting some kind of education because you're not. The end.
There's too much emphasis on, like you just said, people not being able to think for themselves. Everyone's just a empty vessel that can only operate once information is dumped into them with no thought of their own to discern through it and think through it. It's like we're just empty vessels with only other people's opinions to fill up our thoughts and fill up our decisions.
I see. Now, this is where I'm still at as far as uncertainty on all this. Is this just a establishment legacy media hit piece on new media, or is it more, because I almost see like using the specter of the right wing, of racism, all of these things, just as like a persuasive tool for the New York Times audience. But what it really seems to be is an attack on YouTube, because obviously anything that is a print newspaper, even an online newspaper, you still have to like have a subscription to read a whole Wall Street Journal article online. Like they don't get it. So I see this more as like, hey, we're losing ad revenue to this other platform and this needs to be an attack on this other platform. There's too much. Noam Chomsky said, what did he call the New York Times? Agenda setting media. Mm-hmm. That the New York Times is basically, because people consider it trustworthy, the paper of record, it's called. And there's other examples of, you know, other in other media that fit this description. They have been responsible for leading the public into the acceptance of wars and all kinds of other horrors. And, you know, YouTube every day, just the freedom of that is producing a lot of content that calls the legitimacy of media like the New York Times into question. What you guys did, certainly, right? Yep. I mean, you're asking people to question these things that everybody accepts.
Someone at Red Pill said something, and it's a very simple generalization, but I thought about it and it makes so much sense. He said, we're basically dealing with, there's two sides. There's people who watch TV and those who don't.
Yeah.
And I would include with the people who watch TV that they also trust things like the New York Times. You know, it's that faction of the population. And then there's the other half, well, not even half, there's the other side who aren't necessarily right-wing, Republican, or anything. It's just people who aren't buying into that other agenda, that mainstream, mainly heavy leftist perspective. And then there's everybody else who's being clumped into this alt-right, racist, whatever, fill in the blank derogatory accusation. And then that's it. And people who want to buy into that New York Times garbage. And yeah, it's so frustrating because it's so obviously propaganda. Mm-hmm. The tactics are becoming so poor. It's such a shame to see people who are still just trusting it all. It's like, it's not even trying anymore. It's like so obviously newspeak. It's so Orwellian. And even the tactics they're using, like I have to really calm myself down from being too frustrated because it's maddening to see people saying, you know, thinking that censorship is a good thing or shutting people down is a good thing. And it's like, can't you see when the enemy doesn't want to be exposed, when people are calling out the hypocrisy.
Right.
And then the more that we're just taught to fight each other, the less we're able to see the forest for the trees.
Yeah. This Caleb Kane character has also spoken out now about this, said that he is a very much a real person. He does regret going down that path, and he is certainly more on the left, but he really didn't like the way he was used in the article. That seems to be his response to it.
It's also weird.
Yeah, but I mean, one of the things that he said that was really troubling is that YouTube has created almost, I don't know if he thinks this is like a conspiracy, but his exact words were, YouTube is basically an algorithmic pipeline that takes people from libertarianism, seduces people with libertarianism. And now we also see why some of the models or the figures that were used in the article might have been so useful. Starts with libertarianism and pipelines them into the alt-right. And he's also talked about, like, the alt-right brags about this, how we get these naive Ron Paul people to be listening to, like, the Right Stuff network of podcasts, which is, like, very much, very, very alt-right. Mm-hmm. So he obviously has spoken out about his dissatisfaction. And it's hard to understand what's happening with YouTube, but I don't really feel like it's particularly helpful to say that, you know, YouTube is conspiring against non-left-wing content creators. It's a huge corporation. Huge corporations behave a lot like governments do. There are situations that call for scalpels and they have chainsaws, you know? So they act in these sort of sweeping bureaucratic ways to pacify a poorly informed Twitter mob. You know, that Carlos Maza is sort of the triggering event, whereas this guy, Steven Crowder, is saying racist and homophobic things against me. I mean, you heard about all that, right?
I mean, I know that Crowder's been, you know, central figure in all this.
Yeah, absolutely. So this Carlos Maz of this channel called Vox, which is very left wing, you know, they started butting heads around this mashup video that Maza made of Crowder saying things he shouldn't have said, like calling him a lispy queer and stuff like that, like things that are just not optically good, right? If you want to be taken seriously as a media or cultural or news analyst. So, but Crowder is also doing a comedy show. So, it is kind of like level one humor. Like pointing out that a gay person is gay is not particularly, like, it's lost its edge. Yeah. It's not particularly inventive or clever. So, Crowder looks bad in this situation, but this is sort of like the event that is the pretext for this current controversy that's played out over the month of June, is that what are we going to do about racism and homophobia on Twitter? And, you know, Twitter has now put out, YouTube, and they've now put out these new guidelines. Have you seen their new guidelines?
I can only imagine.
It's a lot of things, you know, it's like the mixing of the good and the bad, where you say, oh, well, yeah, I agree with that. You can't threaten the life of a child in a video. Okay, sure. The last one, content claiming that specific victims of public violent incidents or their next of kin are actors.
Whoa.
Or that their experiences are false. So think about, just imagine babies out of the incubator, girl.
Exactly.
Today, in any new situation that is used to be a catalyzing or persuasive event for some military action or some freedom-stealing action, if a person appears in front of the legacy media and says, I'm a victim. Now this is proven that this has happened before. And I know there's lots of incidents around, like, school shootings where it's questionable and there's a lot of debate and people have gotten in trouble for pointing fingers at crisis actors and things like that. But there are definitely fabricated pretexts for military events, for legal crackdowns. All of these things are very real. Now, if you want to make a video alerting people to this, or even discussing it, or even asking questions about it, that is something that could very easily get... Yes, yeah. Exactly. So think about how many of your videos that are even comedy with Joy Camp touched on that idea. Like, how many times do you guys say crisis actors, even with big grins on your face in a video? How many times does that occur? It's scary.
And what's funny is that a sketch that we never got around to making was a meeting of a crisis actor agent talking to a potential crisis actor, and the crisis actor showing off his resume of all the different events he was a part of, and the agent deciding whether or not to take him on as a client. That was a sketch that we always wanted to make, and we just never got around to making it. So that probably would single-handedly get us taken off of YouTube. But it was all comedy, because we're just making fun of how ridiculous all of it is, whether or not it's true or not. Just, it was a funny idea for us.
Yeah.
There's only one, I guess there's two. No, there's three. There's three Joy Camp videos that we never released. So we have unreleased material. And one of them is because it felt like too much of an inside joke for us.
Yeah.
The other one we just didn't think was quality And the other one was because we were a little concerned with what the repercussions might be if we released it. And it was a Conspiracy Guy episode, and it was called Conspiracy Guy Piers Morgan. And we put together this, we hashed together this interview as if he was interviewing me about mass shootings. Mm. And it was right after Sandy Hook. And it's, I was just telling my buddy, it was so frustrating for us because it's one of our most time consuming videos we ever made. We spent so much time because we're trying to like watch all these Piers Morgan interviews and try to find sound bites that we could use to construct a phony conversation with him.
Yeah.
Took forever. And then the editing of matching, like using a green screen and then matching the background and stuff to look like his show. And oh my gosh, this took so much time. And we finally got to the somewhat final product. Kevin and I both watched it and went, I don't know. I think this one could get us in trouble because I say some things right to the camera pretty blatantly. I mean, I look right at the camera and say some things that are really, really like right on the nose. And, but when watching it back, I talk specifically about Sandy Hook and he's asking me questions and I'm like, yeah, there's a chance it didn't happen at all. That they're all actors and that the kids didn't, Adam Lanza didn't even exist. And I'm just casually saying like some conspiratorial things about it. But then I say something that I think now I'm like, wow, I was ahead of the curve. I said, there's a chance that I said, what it seems like is that this whole Sandy Hook thing was set up as bait for conspiracy theorists to get them all crying crisis actor. Cause it does seem in some of those, you know, some of the parents and stuff, they're acting odd considering their kids just died, which is what set people off. And well, I was saying it's bait, like that did set the tone for the next few years. So now that anytime one of these shootings happens, there's a certain group of people, faction people that say crisis actors, false flag, all fake. They're all actors. And when you start with that, you're going to lose most people. They're going to think you're just crazy and also not having any compassion whatsoever. So it did seem like it was this trap that was laid out. So those of us who could see, or those people who could see that it was, you know, perhaps obviously a totally staged event.
Yeah.
Well, you can, even if you firmly believe that, when you lead with that, you're creating a huge schism between being able to reach people who do not want to hear that. And then what we've seen since is just that immediate crisis actor claim and then further fodder for the legacy media to be like, look, see how crazy and dangerous they are. They're actually claiming that these people aren't even telling the truth. They're acting their way through these events and, you know, look at where it's got us. So I say in this video from 2014 or 2013, that the whole crisis actor idea was bait for conspiracy theorists.
Yeah. And like you said, a really useful foil, not just for like creating a narrative, like, look, there's us and there's them, but also leading all the way up to, you know, the possibility of some really strict gun control legislation that's already happened in certain places, like state by state around the country. I live in Pittsburgh. You know, I mean, Pennsylvania in many ways is a pretty free state. The mayor of Pittsburgh, after that shooting happened at the synagogue, like most of my friends, I know a lot of friends here now who suddenly became felons one day with a stroke of the mayor's pen based on things they already had in their house that they weren't going to like transport over state lines. Wow. So, you know, it reminds me too, like the setup there for those kinds of situations and the usefulness, it's a really good insight. It reminds me of Trump. Last show my audience heard was actually a repost of something that Rich does for Tragedy and Hope sometimes called The Deep End. So it's me, Rich, and Kevin Cole. And it was from 2017. And we're just kind of trying to wrap our heads around some aspects of like the Trump phenomenon, like about a year into his presidency. I said he's very good at the Saul Alinsky pick an issue, polarize it kind of thing. Colin Kaepernick kneels for the Pledge of Allegiance, and then Trump calls him an asshole or something, says he should be fired. You know, son of a bitch. That's what he said. So Trump inserts himself into the issue like right before, as his presidency is failing with an election about to start, he inserts himself into a cultural issue, which is highly emotional for most people. And he creates this polarization between, look, there's me, Donald Trump, the guy who loves the country and supports the military. And then there's people not like me who kneel when the national anthem gets played. So you pick. And for most of mainstream America, that's actually going to catalyze support for Trump. So that is kind of the same thing we're seeing here. When one of these incidents comes up, they could say, well, look, you know, there's responsible people like us here on MSNBC and CNN who look at these incidents and have a narrative and then use that narrative as a justification to turn more people away from being able to protect themselves because it's just too goddamn dangerous. As you'd read in the New York Times, like, it's not like people can think for themselves or make responsible or safe decisions. You know, people are radicalized by a website. Mm-hmm. So that narrative is useful there as well.
Yeah. And I think a lot of us have been trying to understand exactly what Trump represents and what he represented and what it means moving forward. And looking back on the last couple of years, what his election and presidency represented was it severed I look at it like if there were a tug of war, right, between the left and the right, for really basic purposes, but there's so much more than just left and right. But for these purposes, left and right, tug of war. So we're holding onto the same rope, but we're tugging it back and forth. And, you know, sometimes it's leaning to the left, sometimes it's leaning to the right. But with Trump coming in, it's like it cut the rope and set both camps absolutely astray. And so there's no chance of reconciliation because nobody wants to hear the other side. And Trump, like, cemented that. He cemented the polarization. You know, regardless of what his intentions are or were or who he is or who he's not, it really did represent this, like, absolute, you know, it defined the sides. And now, I mean, the left, I would say left in particular, they don't want to hear anyone else's point of view. They are absolutely lost in their own self-righteous, you know, crusade. And I can't say that that's Trump's fault, but that's what Trump represents. He represented that things have gotten so escalated as far as, like, emotional, you know, the feeling of everything is just absolutely amped up since he became president. And maybe that was the intention all along. Maybe that's what he represents, because obviously he's not doing some of the things, surprise, surprise, president of the United States, not doing the things he said he was going to do. And if anything, he's playing into some of the really, and supporting some of the really more diabolical aspects of reality at the moment. And it's disappointing. So you have to start wondering, like, well, okay, so what was the purpose of him in the first place? And that gap between the left and everybody else is so wide. It's, I don't see how it can be repaired with ease, you know?
Yeah. Jeez. So I understand, and I would agree with this New York Times reporter, these things are potentially dangerous as far as public discourse, as far as an individual's mental health is concerned. But I will not refuse to, like they do, question the premise that people can't think. So let's act as if nobody can think critically, right? Everything is dangerous if you can't think. Scissors are dangerous, right? If you can't think, it doesn't mean they're not useful. And mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that, you know, they're saying throw out YouTube, throw out anything that competes with, you know, the New York Times ad revenue. But it's not a positive take. It's presenting it as a danger, right? These things are, especially to young people like poor Caleb, who's 26 or 27 years old. But the point was, yeah, I mean, Trump is very much a polarizing figure. And whether it was response to him or things that he does actively, he's had that effect, but it's only been exacerbated by how people are trying to, you know, communicate, I'm throwing mm-hmm. up air quotes again, online, right? Yeah. Because now they're only being fed the things that they want to, they're telling these platforms they want to see. Mm-hmm. And the more, you know, that becomes the normal, the more offensive, the more upsetting viewpoints outside of that bubble are going to be when there is this chance encounter.
Yeah, it wasn't until yesterday. Yeah, just last night I had, I guess I realized and accepted and felt the election season that's coming.
Yeah.
It's going to be a nightmare. It's going to be an absolute nightmare. It's just going to get worse. We're just a little less than a year and a half away from the election. And gosh, I'm not ready for this, for what's in store. And I don't know. I have a feeling we're going to see some really... We didn't see nothing yet. That's my feeling on it all. And
what was it that happened that made you, like, realize this just yesterday?
Just conversations. I mean, yeah. Just thinking about where we're at and realizing, oh man, this is, like, we're halfway through 2019. That means the election is next fall. And let's face it. I mean, again, I'm not a Republican. I'm not right wing. I'm not libertarian. I'm not anarchist. I'm not liberal. I'm none of these things. I'm an anti-labelist. If anything, mm-hmm. You want to apply a label to me, it's unlabelable. the left is they fight dirty. They're so dirty in their tactics. And, you know, and it comes from both sides, just to be fair. But there's something like I equate the way that the left fights, like all the ways I was taught not to fight as a kid. Like they fight dirty. You know, they like kick below the belt and punch below the belt and scratch and bite. And it's that kind of tactics. And they're anything they can to win. And, you know, that Trump's going for a reelection. Whew, I am not ready to see what's going to happen. And the next year and a half. And I think there's going to be, I just have a bad feeling about, especially with all the demonetization and the censorship and all the stuff that's happening now, deplatforming, it's going to get ugly.
Right. So I think it's a bit of a confusing time, and I'm still trying to sort all this out. This confluence of conflict where we see, okay, legacy media attacking threats from new media. We see a battle between left and right for influence of these new platforms, right? That are very much, you know, Dave Pakman, who's this progressive, just does this thing called the Dave Pakman Show. Smart guy, younger guy, non-hysterical left-wing person that, you know, he does a lot of like red meat for his audience, like Trump sucks, Trump's an idiot, those kinds of videos. But he's a pretty thoughtful guy, and he was recently on Rogan. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was saying, yeah, it's like maybe Joe was putting forth this idea that a lot of these companies like Twitter and Facebook, as people like Tim Pool has been trying to show, have these, you know, pretty hardcore left-wing biases. And, you know, Pakman was saying, well, there are also these big corporations who also behave in a lot of what people would associate or describe as right-wing ways. And I saw that was interesting. So does the Alphabet Corporation that owns YouTube have a globalist agenda? Is it important for, you know, long-term success to ingratiate themselves with the existing power structure, you know, as it is in the world? Is it really a disruptor, you know, mm-hmm. or is it just trying to blend with the existing controllers of the world? Or is it the new controller of the world? I mean, these are all things that for me are unsettled at this point. It's scary. I mean, Google is scary as hell. But all of that social media stuff is contributing to this. You talk about the left fighting dirty. I think it's a feature of left-wing ideas as they're presented more in the academy as well. It's very Puritan, right? It has a real 500 years ago religious type affect to it, a lot of these people, where they believe they're in a perpetual war with the devil. Mm-hmm. And if people need to be drowned or crushed with stones to fight the devil, which is racism and misogyny and all these things, that if you say, why is diversity good? The response you might get is, I don't even justify that with a response. I can't even, whatever they say, they don't know. It's entirely faith-based. Right. Mm-hmm. Not to say there aren't good things about diversity here and there in some places, of course, but they can't defend their ideas. It is just this faith-based thing. And so they know they're on the side of good. They know they're warring against the devil. And if somebody is not on your side, they've aligned themselves with the devil. So that's why they fight dirty. I think by any means necessary is their approach.
And they're being told that it's okay to punch first, which I think is that's just awful. I mean, that's like such a principle of life. Like, you do not throw the first punch. You know, defending yourself is absolutely allowed and encouraged and empowering to be taught. You know, if someone aggresses upon you, you have the right to defend yourself. But the left is being taught to punch a Nazi, that it's okay because of their ideology, because of their points of view, regardless, that it's okay for you because you are such a justice warrior that it's okay to punch first. That alone is proof that it's, you know, pretty has pretty bad intentions behind it.
But that's actually their position would be that's retaliatory violence, because the violence is discursive. The violence was the speech, right? Violence was letting like Ben Shapiro or Milo Yiannopoulos onto your campus. That was an act of violence because it made people feel alienated and unsafe. So
pretty retarded reasoning there.
Whoa.
I said it. It's retarded. It's retarded thinking. It's emotionally based, anti-logic, even loving. I mean, it's retarded. And I'm okay. I don't mind saying that word. Retarded just means stunted thinking.
Right. Let's talk more about you as we walk down here.
That's segue.
You know, you were talking about Conspiracy Guy, which was this recurring character in the Joy Camp videos through the years that, man, you also recently on your new YouTube channel, which it's just Benny Wills, right, on YouTube now?
Benny Wills YouTube channel, yep.
So your most recent like three pack of videos is Conspiracy Guy AMA, right?
It's only a three pack because I had no idea what I was doing.
Now, it is you, Benny, but okay, so this was my take, and tell me if I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. Conspiracy Guy is a character. So mm-hmm. Joy Camp is not like, all right, this is what we think chemtrails are. This is what we think happened at Sandy Hook. This is what shape we think the Earth actually is. This is how many people we think didn't go to the moon. It always struck me as not conclusive, but more exploratory, right? Yeah. Like, in many ways, it was like, yeah, you know, I'm interested in this. Like, do I want to believe that Stanley Kubrick helped NASA fake the moon landing? Of course I do. That's a very sexy thing to believe.
It's one of my favorites.
I would like it if that were true. You know, but I feel like people do. There's a lot of conspiracy jackoffery, and like I know something you don't know. People are always trying to, you know, collect more information, but because there's other people who know more about 9/11 or whatever this thing is that I don't. So I have to, you know, keep being vigilant and trying to learn more, even though there isn't much new about like something like 9/11 truth in the last 10 years. And the truth, unfortunately, it didn't accomplish that much either. But it sucked away a lot of time, a lot of emotional resources from people. And I'm not saying that's a justification of the official narrative of 9/11, but I think at this point, almost 20 years later, the usefulness of that whole pursuit is very questionable, or the effectiveness of that whole pursuit is very questionable. But you guys seem to understand that there was a way to approach all of that lightheartedly. The things that were destroying people's relationships, the things that were, you know, causing others like a great deal of emotional torment, that you were just exploring this and you were having fun with it. And maybe you had a lot of questions about official narratives too, but Conspiracy Guy is not a vehicle to put Kevin's or Benny's views out into the world exactly as they are. Is that fair?
That's totally fair. Yes, exactly. Because I say this often when I'm like ranting to my friends that I'm so sick of arrogance from all sides, no matter what side of the spectrum you're on or what you consider yourself to be, have some humility. But so many people are arrogant in what they believe to be true. And you can use your critical thinking and discernment to navigate. But when it comes to beliefs, so much is questionable. Even if it seems very likely that something happened in a certain way, it's really hard to know exactly what happened. There's so much proselytizing and there's so much arrogance behind it on all sides. Even if they're absolutely right, there's a lot of arrogance behind it.
Yeah.
And we wanted to show that here's some ideas. And even if we lean towards believing those ideas and at least entertaining those ideas, that we're not here to teach you or tell you how to think.
Right.
We're here to encourage you to think. And we don't take sides. Again, you can sense where we're at, but we're not there to lecture. We're not trying to convince you that this is the way it's supposed to be. And we're keeping it open. Like, we try to do it with the Conspiracy Guy videos, especially as we went along with them. We wanted to show two sides in a way.
Yeah.
Like we did our Flat Earth video.
That's what I was thinking of. Yep.
Okay, no peeking.
Here we go. Keep your eyes closed.
Okay, they're closed.
All right. Keep going. Almost there.
Be careful.
There.
How much further?
We're almost there.
Right about.
Hey!
Here we are.
Happy Earth Day, dude.
Guys, how'd you know?
We know you love Earth.
That's my favorite day of the year.
This is the day.
It's your favorite planet, man.
I just love coming up to high spots and looking at it.
I know. So we planned out the day. We're going to enjoy the Earth, and then we're going to go get some butter burgers.
Oh, yep. I get burgers and Earth?
Burgers and butter.
Snap. Today really is my day, right, guys?
I know.
Wow. Dude,
look, man, it just goes on and on on forever.
That could be because the Earth is flat. I don't see any curvature. Yeah, that horizon looks very, very flat to me.
paying separately though for the burgers.
Yeah, definitely paying separately for the burgers.
You can come with us.
I only have my card.
I mean, it's definitely not curving down.
Do you guys know this guy? Anybody?
I have no idea where it came from.
If anything, the horizon is rising to meet our eye line.
They call it the horizon.
Yeah, they sure do. But that's not where and there's also a little something called gravity.
Whoa. Gravity is a theory. It's just a theory.
Oh, no, he did not.
It's actually it's not a law. It's a theory. It's a movie.
It's
definitely a movie.
If
but
Clooney's
it's,
in it, it's got to be real. You know that.
If light things can rise up and heavy things can fall down, it might just be simply a natural byproduct of weight and density.
If Neil deGrasse Tyson was here, he would just like mushroom stamp the hell out of you.
Listen, Neil deGrasse Tyson says that the world is pear-shaped.
No, Neil deGrasse Tyson is pear-shaped.
Does this look pear-shaped to you? That looks pretty round to me. In fact, that might even be a perfect circle. But to be fair, this photo is Photoshopped. In fact, NASA even admits that every image you see of the Earth is actually Photoshopped.
Are you talking shit on NASA,
bro? Did you just say NASA is wrong?
Look, all I'm saying is that if they can convince you that the world that you're living on is not actually what it is, then they can pretty much convince you of anything.
You know what I know? I know that hamburgers are real, and I know that we're gonna go get one.
I gotta respond to myself and say that there's also a good chance that this whole flat Earth revival is just one big massive psyop.
What is this?
It's obviously a distraction, and it's dividing the community at a time when we need to be more united than ever because the system is going into lockdown mode. You know, 1984 is upon us. There's water depletion. There's deforestation. There's mandatory vaccinations. Every move is being monitored. There's never-ending war. The psychopaths are posing as leaders, and we're down here debating on whether or not the Earth is flat.
Yeah, but no one can prove it.
Ah! On the contrary, my friend, I intend to put an end to this debate once and for all.
He flew right up there in a jetpack.
I didn't see that coming.
That thing was fast.
That was pretty cool. Actually, kind of looks like chemtrails behind him.
What are chemtrails?
Remember chemtrails?
No.
That big craze from 2012.
Are they still around?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. Who cares?
Yeah. So, hey, did you know McDonald's has a new custom burger?
Yeah.
It's called the Build-A-Burger.
Really?
Yeah.
Put whatever you want on it?
Oh, yeah. Whatever
Sounds
you
good
want.
To me.
Yeah, it's
Can
great.
We still get a Butterburger from Burger King?
Oh, dude, we're going to get a Butterburger, and then we're going to get a Build-A-Burger.
Is he telling the truth, or is he telling a lie? He's the conspiracy guy.
I think is one of our best, not because I necessarily even love it that much, but I think it's one of our best because we were able to reach the flat Earth community and, let's say, the globe Earth community. And that's hard to do. That topic is so polarized. I mean, people have extreme opinions in either direction on that one, and it's hard to bridge a gap.
Right.
And, we were. I mean, we had flat earthers saying, like, great video, even though we don't claim to be on that side. But I was really just posing my same, I mean, as an open-minded person, what I was going through about flat earth. I was listening, going, okay, these are the points they're making, A, B, C, D, about why it's flat. But how do we actually really prove that? So I made the joke, like, okay, yeah, it might be flat because of this, this, and this. That said, look at the division it's causing. Look at it's divisive in nature. And how many of us have been up in space to look down on the Earth? Zero that I know. So I made that joke at the end, like, okay, I'm going to settle this score. I'm going to go up here with a camera and take some pictures. And then it has this goofy ending where I'm wearing a rocket pack. But I say, yeah, I start the half of the video with me saying, yep, it could be flat for these reasons. Then I say it actually could just be one big psyop here to trick us all.
Yes. Yeah. I love that.
So it's both sides. Mm-hmm. And then it was received well by both sides. And I was like, it's bringing people back together and off of their islands where they believe things dogmatically.
Mm-hmm. So conspiracy guy, zoom out to Joy Camp with that as a, I guess it was what, like 6 or 7 year foundation of putting that work out. Mm-hmm. What's next for you?
Well, what's next is continuing to explore this, you know, my life as an individual and sharing that with the world. I mean, before I go too much into that, it's funny that, you know, you referenced this AMA I did the other day, which was really fun, in spite of the technical difficulties I had. I basically set that up just so I could tell people to come subscribe to my new channel because it's really hard to get anyone's attention. online. And I wanted to do that, but I called it an AMA because why not? Like, I'll answer some questions. If anybody has any questions, happy to answer them. And it ended up being really fun. And then when it was over, I thought, man, I could have been doing this for the past 2 years. I could have been doing this at any point. So I might actually really keep exploring that angle because I'm such a perfectionist because I worked very hard at, you know, being a good actor first and now a writer. And with Joy Camp, it's all about giving you this great final product. So I've always been really, it's hard for me not to give the people something that's polished and ready to go. So I've always kind of shied away from just making it raw and giving you where I'm at right now in this moment. But I want to lean into that a little bit because it was fun and it's easy.
Yeah.
And people like it, and people, for whatever reason, seem to want to know what I have to say about things and think about things. And that's cool. I'll do it if they want to do it. So I want to incorporate that. And I didn't know that I even wanted to explore that avenue until I just happened to do a, you know, spontaneous Ask Me Anything conspiracy guy on the JoyCam channel. So we'll see. Now, that said, what I've been in motion to do already for a while now, what I really decided to step into just last week, was my own individual sharing of things, my path, because it's all changed in the last few years. I started getting invited more and more to events and stuff, and I've been writing poetry, and I've been writing poetry since I was a kid, but never really thinking much of it, just having it as a hobby, because I was so focused on acting for so long, and nothing else I was good at or was interested in ever even entered my thoughts about what I could do with my life. And I got invited to speak at Anarchapulco in 2017, and I had a 40-minute slot, I think. And I thought, well, I don't want to do a PowerPoint presentation. I don't consider myself necessarily an expert on any particular subject. I can hold my own in conversations, but I'm not an expert on topics like other speakers are. So what am I good at? I'm a good performer. I spend a lot of time on stage. I'm very comfortable on stage. So maybe I'll just perform some of these poems I've been writing that I write for myself and share with my friends that I sort through big ideas with I said, screw it, you know, I'll go out there, and if people hate it, they hate it, and I'll go back home and cuddle up with my girlfriend and be just fine. So I took a risk and performed poetry at this event, and it was received so well. I got 3 standing ovations in my 40 minutes on stage. It was very activating, and I decided to really step into it, and I made it a goal. So, okay, I'm a poet now. Now I'm a poet. Mm-hmm. And I committed to having a discipline as far as creating. So I'm always working on something. So I have a discipline as far as writing goes. And it's really been in motion now. So since then, I've performed literally all over the world and gone to several conferences and events. And now I'm being asked to MC events like Red Pill and share my stuff. And it's getting to a point now where I'm in the world, not as a representative of Joy Camp, but just as Benny Wills. So when people have been asking me for years now, where do we find your stuff? I'm like, well, I have a YouTube channel called Joy Camp. It's all comedy, but my poetry, not really there. There's a couple things on there, but and people always want it, and I don't have anything to offer them. So, and I've been wrestling back and forth with whether or not to put it on the Joy Camp channel or not, because Joy Camp, like you said, was a troupe. It was a group thing, and it's not all about me.
Right.
And I didn't want to confuse the issue anymore. So I've been scared of starting over from zero, especially now with what's happening with YouTube. And who knows, maybe I'm already buried because they know who I am. It's possible. But I thought, why not? You know, it's not about the numbers anyway. So I'm doing something that I think is important. People tell me as much. So I'm really just leaning into it and seeing what happens. And it's so far so good.
Yeah. And at the very least, it's useful as, you know, a definable digital presence that actually allows you to promote yourself for future engagements like Red Pill or Anarchapoco or other events that, that you could go and be a, you know, a leader or an MC. I think that's awesome.
I have a book in the works that Mr. G. Edward Griffin has said he will publish. So that's good. I have that to sell. It's a book of poetry. What's cool and what really has given me the fuel to really step into this is the feedback I get. Whereas we got messages of appreciation for Joy Camp, you know, throughout the years, the messages I'm getting now from people that I'm, you know, stepping out as an individual and it's really speaking from the heart in a really, I don't know, fun, melodic way, the gratitude I'm receiving now is different. It's much more personal and much more heartfelt. And people are, I mean, telling me their life stories. Like they're emailing me long paragraph after paragraph accounts of their own life and how the effect I've had on them and how much they appreciate my work. And I don't know, it's definitely fuel to keep going. And I've had multiple people tell me now that my work and also Joy Camp helped them move through suicidal moments in their life. Cause I know that going down, not being a part of the mainstream, not being a part of the herd can be very lonely and
alienation
and sometimes feel very hopeless. So people have found me as a beacon, and I'm sure they have for you as well. I mean, that's what we all kind of share is this people who are drawn to you and then they're so happy that you exist. And that's awesome. And I just love being able to contribute in a positive way and know that I'm making a difference in some people's lives. So it's easy to get caught up in the numbers, and I'm trying to just not, and just saying, you know, whoever's receiving it are the right people to receive it. And the last thing I want to say about it is going back to what you said earlier about content for content's sake, sort of, right?
Yeah.
That's something I've had a problem with for years now. And I think that while I don't agree with censorship or shutting people down, the demonetization that's happening on YouTube, while it's difficult and shitty, it's also giving people an opportunity to not be dependent on having to show advertisements on their videos in order to get paid by Google. And I think that's a good thing. Not that it's good that they're doing it, but it's good to not be reliant on it. Because what I found, content creators that I like sometimes on YouTube, is they're producing too much content because they need it. They need to in order to sustain their lifestyle. And I don't want any strain. I'm not doing poetry because I want to be rich. If you want to give me money to do it, absolutely. And if people want me to come to their event, I have my price tag.
Yeah.
It's my worth and it's an energetic exchange. That said, if I were to go into it thinking this is my new career and I need to get paid to do this, then it puts a strain on my output, puts a strain on my artwork. And then there's always something in the back of my mind that's saying, I need to do this so I can get paid, so I can keep paying the bills. I'd be awesome to be, you know, rich because of poetry, but I'm not looking at it, at my contribution online, as my way of being able to afford food and gas. And I think that's important. I mean, I think that we can, you know, I think people's content would improve overall if they didn't have that extra strain of, I need to do this so that I can, you know, keep paying rent.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, I think I've looked at it from this place of appreciation, of gratitude over the last few years. Like, I love what I do. So then the follow-up question is, how can I continue to do what I love to do? Bills need to get paid, right? Gas tanks need to be filled. Food needs to be cooked to make this whole operation possible in the background. And so then it becomes a question, and a lot of it has to do with self-discipline too, things like time management and with clarifying goals, with being you know, mindful of a purpose. You know, I see what you do. I think you really, you know, you nailed it in that space in which you operate, in which you've done so much of your work. You and the guys you worked with were very much a beacon that gave people positivity when they might have been drowning, like you pointed out, in paranoia or alienation or hopelessness. And there's a lot of people from the outside who are piling on people who are seeking the truth about things outside of the mainstream narrative, right? And they're portrayed as being very negative. And there's plenty of mentally ill people to find to say, look, people who think that there's such a thing as crisis actors. Vice did a documentary about this very sick man who goes around and harasses the families of these people. And that becomes the avatar of conspiracy theorist or truth seeker or person questioning the normal narrative. And there is a lot of unhealthiness in that world. And I immediately understood that what you guys were doing, or it was immediately apparent to me that this was like a bright spot that could, for a lot of people, lighten their load and allow them to reframe their emotional load and reframe, you know, their potentially, it could at least be like a stepping stone to reframing one's whole worldview and remembering, like, it's important to laugh. It's important to connect with people. It's important to have some appreciation for things in life because, yeah, you might have a video that hits on some conspiracy topic, but then the next thing would be like very, very positive, right? It would have a really positive message to it. And you know, once you hooked people in or got people to subscribe based on one of these ideas, they would certainly be back for more. So I am just backing up what I said at the beginning of the show that I thought it was really important work that you guys are doing. I'm sure you're going to continue it. And I want to make sure that people in my audience, I think there was a lot of overlap between School Sucks podcast listeners and Joy Camp YouTube subscribers. So I want to make sure people know where you went and how they can stay in touch with what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And so the funny thing about YouTube, well, there's YouTube is a pretty funny operation altogether, but you have to have a channel for 30 days and have 1,000+ subscribers to get a custom URL.
Mm-hmm.
So when I guide people to JoyCamp, all I have to do is say, go to youtube.com/JoyCamp. But I can't say that for my own channel because I haven't reached the 30 days yet. I have over 1,000 subscribers, but luckily, which is awesome, but my YouTube URL is like youtube.com/PQRTSUV and then 20 other characters.
But not really that. Don't start typing it, everybody. That's not the link.
So I'll send you the link and you can put it in the, I don't know, the notes or whatever. But if you type in Benny Wills channel, I'm assuming that'll come up. Another way to do it is just go to BennyWills.com. That's my new website, BennyWills.com. And on there's links to the channel. So that's, you know, if you're having a hard time finding me on YouTube, which shouldn't be that hard, go to the website, BennyWills.com. I have a Facebook page. You can also friend me on Facebook. I'm just me. I'm not trying to, you know, put walls between me and anybody who wants to find me, except for maybe the NSA, but that's probably too late. I'm Benny Wills on Facebook, Instagram. I even have a Twitter, even though I haven't tweeted in probably 6 years. But the YouTube channel is what I want to grow. And if other platforms emerge that seem more like better options to YouTube, I'll join those as well. But YouTube is the main one because it's harder to censor something like poetry. And I touch on all the same subjects that everyone else does, but I do it poetically. And I think it's harder to shut down art.
Yeah.
So I think that my, you know, if I do say so myself, I think what I'm doing is important and it can maybe defy the algorithm somewhat.
I absolutely agree. I think that's a really, really great point. Right. Because there were names once upon a time for people who tried to censor art and free expression. And they were really like kind of at odds with a lot of the people who are pushing censorship today. So that's an interesting proposition. I look forward to hopefully seeing you be successful with that, because I think you're right.
Thanks. Yeah. And whatever, as long as I stay persistent and focused and with the right intentions, wherever it leads me is the right path. So if it goes away from YouTube, that's fine. But I could use the support because it took us 7 years to get 21,000 subscribers on YouTube for JoyCamp.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want it to take that long to get a following on for my new channel. So it would be great if anybody who likes JoyCamp or who likes me subscribe, because I have literally dozens of things I need to post on there that are ready to go. And I might dabble in this live stream stuff because it was really fun and people seem to appreciate it. And it's a really easy way to create content and a fun way. So there's I think this channel, I don't know, I feel free now. Like, I'm actually really excited about content creation, which I haven't been for a couple of years because I've been waffling on whether or not to make a joy camp or step out on my own. And I've just kind of been on the fence. And now that I've done it, I'm really excited. Now yeah. I have free reign. I can do whatever I want. And, you know, I think that's really exciting. And again, I could use some audience. So find
absolutely.
Me on YouTube, BennyWells.com.
Well, the people listening to this, we know how these phones you have work. And right in whatever podcast app you're listening to, there are notes and there is a hyperlink that opens your YouTube app and allows you to subscribe to Benny's channel. So if you're still listening, which you obviously all are, please subscribe to Benny's channel. Like, how many subs you at right now?
Oh, gosh. I think I'm just about to reach 1,400. So that's pretty good for 1 week, but... You know.
Oh my God. I'm leaving in a couple of days to go on a trip where I will be pretty disconnected from the online world during that time. I would love to come back and find that you had like 2,500 on next Tuesday, which is a week from today.
Let's make it 25,000.
Yeah, why not?
I'm an ambitious guy.
Absolutely. So Benny, we're 3 for 3 as far as having really enjoyable conversations.
Yeah, totally, man.
Appreciate you taking the time, two of which we recorded. Mm-hmm. And I would definitely love to do this again. I think there's lots of insights that you have about, you know, being a performer and having the confidence and the ability to get up in front of people. It's such an important skill that I'm really actually working behind the scenes. I'm going to start doing these virtual summits soon. And one of the things, it actually started like, how do you improve your research skills was going to be the first topic for the first virtual summit. I put together this amazing list of presenters, including Rich, Kevin, Jay Dyer. And that's all a package that's going to go live at the end of the summer. But I really want people to not only, in my audience, not only have the ability to do better research, but also to have the confidence to share it with other people in constructive and connected ways. So I would certainly love to have you back. We could talk about all sorts of subtopics related to that.
Can I comment on that real quick?
Yeah.
I absolutely agree. And something I find myself having to repeat to people when I meet them in person, because people are generally impressed with my ability to be on stage and to relay a message. And they're always really impressed with the memorization, which as an actor is the easiest thing.
Yeah.
But what I have to remind people of is I didn't just wake up with the ability to perform and to be comfortable on stage and to convey a message in a really intriguing way. It took me 20 plus years of training and practice and criticism and feedback and continuing, you know, not giving up to be able to get to a point where I can do that. And granted, it was all for acting, but then I was able to use those skills and apply to what I'm doing now, which is like the ultimate, you know, coalescence. Yeah. But it takes a lot of time to make something look effortless. I mean, I have to emphasize that to people sometimes because they're like, how do you do it? And I want to try that. Well, good, try it. But just know that what I'm doing comes from a lifetime of preparation. Literally a lifetime of preparation. I didn't just wake up one day and I was automatically good. No, I was not good when I started. So I don't say people go out and do what I do. I do what I do because it's what I do. But everyone does have something they can contribute and something they are good at and some kind of calling that they can tap into. And the key is to just move through the fear of what people will think or what it will look like or not thinking you have something to say and just, you know, fumble your way through it. Stumble your way through it. Go for it. Participate because this world needs it more than ever. And it doesn't necessarily have to be as a YouTube personality. Who cares? But you have something to offer and you just got to let it out.
Awesome. Benny, thank you so much. This was a great conversation. I look forward to our next one.
Me too, Brett. Thanks for having me.
Bam.